Preston Hall in Scotland was built by Lord Adam Gordon, who spent every working hour of 31 years supervising its construction. On the day it was completed, he lost interest in the castle and sold it. Believe it or not.
That's a cut from 1930s vintage Ripley's Believe It or Not episode, which always started with a quick teaser story and then followed with a longer story. The alchemy that brought such success to this program, which started as a part of the Sunday comics and also moved into television, perhaps could only have been mastered by a man such as Robert Ripley, born Leroy Robert Ripley in Santa Rosa, California, in 1890. Joining us now to talk about Ripley, his life and times, is Neil Thompson, author of the new biography, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Thanks, Anne. Good to be here.
One of the endorsements for the book said that anyone who wants to understand America needs to read this book. And I have to say that Ripley was in every way a man of his times, who lived in a time when exploiting those times was a way to get anywhere, but absolutely a man of his time.
Yeah, I think he was a man of his time and sort of this overlooked American character. I love that quote that you just cited, because I think what I loved about researching Ripley's story is learning that not only was it overlooked, but it's still relevant to today. A lot of the things that he was curious about and shared with his readers and listeners are the things that I think still titillate people today, the strange, the weird, the bizarre.
And there were some other aspects to him. He had a visionary ability when it came to the business that he was in or wanted to be in. A couple things stand out. One is where you describe the sort of writing he did when he was traveling as an early form of what we consider blogging now.
Yeah, it really was. So you know, Ripley started out as just a sports cartoonist. That was his initial job, first in San Francisco, then in New York. Then as he expanded beyond drawing just sports cartoons, he started traveling the world, writing essays about the places he visited, drawing pictures about the strange people and cultures he experienced. And his travel essays were just remarkably chatty. You know, it wasn't necessarily reportage or history or straight up, the type of journalism you would get at that time. It was Ripley, this sort of goofy American traveler, traipsing around the world, drinking with new friends and visiting headhunters, and then telling his readers in this very conversational way that is very much like today's blogging.
And then I was fascinated. Is it really true that he was the first cartoonist to ship his cartoons overseas via a predecessor of the facsimile?
Yeah, it's there were different versions of that technology that were at play in the 1920s. A lot of what he liked to do is not only feature bests and mosts and firsts and largest and weirdest and that kind of thing in his cartoons, but he liked to achieve those things himself in his radio shows or in other ways. So in 1926, he was covering the Derby horse race in England and quickly drew a cartoon of the winner and then went to a newspaper office, and they, essentially at that time, it wasn't called the fax, but basically faxed it across the Atlantic to the U.S., where it was then reprinted in newspapers.
Which is quite amazing. Otherwise, the only other alternative was to mail it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you would get your news weeks later after Ripley sending his cartoons back by mail.
And then finally, I mean, before we move on to his life, someone called him the godfather of reality TV, and I thought about it for a long time and figured, you know what? I think they're right.
Yeah, again, it's that the appeal for me, the appealing part of Ripley's story was not only this fascinating life that he lived, but that it's so, what he featured during his day is so relevant to today. And I think you see examples of Ripley all around us in reality TV, on YouTube, where you see people just doing weird stuff, mm-hmm. Trying to get noticed. I think he was really not only a man ahead of his time, but someone who really tapped into the American psyche and pop culture.
My guest is Neil Thompson. He's a veteran journalist and author of a new biography. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. If you're a Ripley fan, you want to give us a call and tell us your favorite story from Ripley, I just want to ask a question of Neil Thompson. You're welcome. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. So let's get back to the young Ripley now. He has said that the best place he could have come from was his hometown of Santa Rosa, California. What made it special? Why do you think that was the case?
Well, it's interesting that he later in life would look back on his childhood so fondly, because in fact he was raised relatively poor and experienced hardship as a child. He was this sort of awkward, geeky kid. He was born with these really disfiguring buck teeth, so he grew up shy, very much alone, teased by some of the other kids. Then a little bit later in his teens, his father dies when Ripley is, I think, 15. His hometown is leveled by the 1906 earthquake. So he experienced some rough times, and yet he looked back later in life very fondly on the experiences that he had in Santa Rosa, I think some of which involved the freedom he had. His parents both worked, and so he was able to explore the town on his own and spent a lot of his time in Santa Rosa's Chinatown, where he got to know the local proprietors and would hear stories about China. And interestingly, China became sort of a theme and obsession for the rest of his life. It was his favorite country. He decorated his houses in Chinese decor. He had Chinese girlfriends. So it's interesting that a lot of it started in that childhood, despite all his troubles.
When I think about him, I get a sense of somebody who is very willing and able to live in the moment, to be where he was and look around him exactly at the moment that he was there.
Absolutely, and it's an admirable quality. You know, as I dug into his life, I realized he really does just live for the moment. He wasn't one for self-reflection. He just sort of plowed ahead in this sort of sometimes heedless way, sometimes just enthusiastic way. He just did what he wanted to do. And I think that sense of living in the moment and that sense of enthusiasm and awe, really, I mean, I think the reason we titled the book A Curious Man is because that's what drove him, is it this curiosity and amazement about the world around him and his sort of relentless pursuit about for the things that made him, you know, gape at the world.
What inspired you to write a biography about Ripley now?
Well, you and I were talking before the introduction there about how I grew up with Ripley's cartoons. I was a newspaper reporter for many years, and so it was just around me as a kid. Read his cartoons in the newspaper. He was long gone at that point. It was being drawn by someone else. But I would read the Ripley books that came out every year. There were TV shows now and then over the years. So I just, you know, I had this general awareness of the Ripley's Believe It or Not concept. But it wasn't until 2007, reading a story in the New York Times about a new Ripley's museum that had opened up in Times Square in New York. And the writer, in just a couple of paragraphs, described Ripley the man. And it was really the first time I thought, oh, of course, there was a guy named Ripley. He created all this. I wonder what his life was about, because I had never been exposed to it. So that afternoon, I spent hours on the internet looking for a book. I assumed there was a book out there about his life and couldn't find one. So literally that afternoon, I dropped a different book project that I'd been working on and just dove into the life of Ripley and spent 5 years working on it.
How did you find out so much about him? It's definitely great storytelling to read about his life, and done pretty seamlessly.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. The research was a blast. It's always the most enjoyable part for me. The writing comes more difficultly. But the research, I was fortunate enough to get the cooperation of a company called Ripley Entertainment. This is the company that still operates or franchises the Ripley museums around the world. They still create a daily Believe It or Not cartoon. And they had never allowed a a writer to get too close to Ripley's story. I think they wanted to keep protection of their brand.
Mm-hmm.
But I convinced them that now was the right time to allow someone to finally fully tell Ripley's story. And thankfully, they opened up their archives to me. There's this climate-controlled room at their headquarters in Orlando, Florida, where they have all of Ripley's stuff that he left behind, that they've collected over the years. And it was an absolute treasure trove for a researcher. And I spent many happy hours in there digging through their dusty files and reading Ripley's travel journals and personal letters and watching old home movies and flipping through photos. It was just fantastic.
You know, I mean, there might be his personal journals. I can't imagine what those were like, because his public journaling was so revealing.
Yeah, you're right, and it's interesting that the private journals weren't that different. I think he was so open and honest with himself and with his readers that you're right. His stories in the newspaper read very much like his journals. He was just happy to tell the world what he was seeing, to introduce people to the weird people he met. He was just giddy about it all.
Was he particularly gifted as an artist? I thought the story about the teacher that let him answer questions by drawing pictures, that was a really interesting idea.
Yeah, and I love that. You know, we touched earlier about how his childhood, he looked back on it so fondly. The one thing he had going for him was his drawing. He was a very talented artist, but he was entirely self-taught. It was just the thing that he loved to do, and he did it all the time. He just doodled in notebooks, and he had this one teacher, one of many sort of patrons he ran into over the years, who would help him sort of get on to the next phase of his life or career. And this teacher could tell how shy he was and how embarrassed he was about his buck teeth. At that time, the kids had to give presentations in front of the class, and this was excruciating for Ripley because not only did he have the buck teeth, he was a stutterer. So the teacher decided, you know, you like to draw. How about instead of writing your essays and presenting them to the class, you draw them, and then we present those drawings to the class. And I think that was really a formative experience for Ripley. But he never received any formal training in art as a child. It wasn't until after he had lost his first newspaper cartooning job that he realized, I need to get serious about this. He started taking classes. This is in San Francisco. And really, from that point forward, focused heavily on his drawing and became a very, very talented artist. So some of his work, some of it's cartoony cartoons, mm-hmm. but a lot of it is really newspaper art.
And I want to ask you about the difference between those two things when we return. My guest is Neil Thompson, veteran journalist and author of a new biography, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
You gotta get an internship to get a paying job, but new graduates considering unpaid internships maybe shouldn't.
Students are basically receiving a negative wage. It's worse than working for free. They're actually paying to work.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Unpaid internships aren't all they're cracked up to be. You know, the story next time on Marketplace from APN.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Thurber House, presenting best-selling author Jeff Shara, reading from the second book of his Civil War trilogy, A Chain of Thunder, a novel of the Siege of Vicksburg. Shara will speak Monday evening, June 3rd, at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets and more details at thurberhouse.org.
You're listening to 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. We bring you NPR News every morning and evening, 7 days a week.
Yaga, a Hindu fakir, buried himself in sand with only his arms exposed to extend a begging bowl to people passing by 6 hours each day for 12 years, believe it or not.
That's a cut from a 1930s vintage Ripley's Believe It or Not episode on radio. It always started with a quick teaser story, then followed with a longer tale. Still with us is Neil Thompson, author of a new biography of Robert Ripley. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Once again, Neil, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Anne. This is fun.
Robert Ripley visited 201 countries in his life, but he seemed to have a special affinity for a few of them. You mentioned earlier China and made the connection between China and Chinatown. India was very important to him as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this obsession with traveling, I think, does, like we were talking earlier, tie back to his childhood, where he met these proprietors in Chinatown and would get little bits of stories about their homeland. And then in the 19-teens, when he was finally making a little bit of money as a sports cartoonist, he began traveling when he could. But it was really this big trip he took in 1921. He was working for a newspaper called the New York Globe, and they sent him around the world. It was called created a series of drawings and essays that they titled Ripley's Ramble Around the World. And it's really an adventure that changed his life, because he was finally able to visit China, which he had always dreamed about, but also, as you said, visited India, which he had read about and had this curiosity about. And once he finally experienced it, he was blown away by what he saw, just the differences that he saw in how people lived there. He was sort of shocked and troubled by the poverty that he saw there. But he had this amazement for it too, particularly that clip just hinted at his interest in what he called the fakirs, the religious aesthetics, and particularly in this one city called Benares, which now goes by a different name, but it's a holy city, holy Hindu city, and he was just fascinated by these mostly men who would prove their devotion by doing terrible things to their bodies, you know, staring at the sun until they went blind, lying on a bed of nails, hanging from a tree by a hook. He just couldn't believe this. In fact, on this formative travel around the world, he sent 8 dispatches home from Benares, and then later when he was in Europe, he only sent 1 or 2 from Paris and from Rome, because I think he was far more engaged by what he witnessed in places like India and China.
A pattern that had emerged, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he did have something of a fear of poverty and poor people, lower class people.
Yeah, there was this strange duality in Ripley's personality, maybe more than dual. He was very curious about people in other places, but he did have a fear of people who people of color, people who begged on the streets. I describe him as someone who wanted to get close to that part of the world, but not necessarily get his hands dirty with it. He wanted to present pictures and stories about those folks to his readers, but he talks about not being able to help them and not knowing what to do about that part of the world. So he had different views on women too. Sometimes he loved them. Sometimes so I guess we'll get to that. But, complex character.
He's very complex, you know. And he saw a lot of wrong in the world, as you mentioned. But he was not interested in being a reformer. That wasn't, you know, some journalists are activist journalists. That was not his shtick.
No, I think it troubled him. But he knew he couldn't do anything about it. And there's one line in the book that I got from one of his travel journals. He says something about not being able to reform the world because I can't even reform myself. You know, so again, that willingness to share, overshare with readers and admit to his own shortcomings, and at times overshare to the point where he would make people cringe, especially as we look back from the perspective of today on some of his attitudes of the time.
Let's get back to your distinction between cartoon drawings and newspaper art. You wrote that World War I allowed Ripley to abandon the typical cartoon drawings and create newspaper art. What's the distinction, and how did World War I play into that?
Well, at that time, in newspapers, photography was very rare, if it appeared at all. And so newspapers relied pretty heavily, some of them did, not all, on cartoonists to draw for the sports pages in particular and some of the other sections. But a lot of the cartoons up until that point were what we think of as comics. The early versions of Mutt and Jeff at that time, the seminal cartoon of the day, this cartoon called The Yellow Kid. So they were more, as I describe them, sort of cartoony. Ripley, when he starts drawing images about World War I, creates these half-page spreads of, for example, there was one that drew a soldier sort of in mid-stride as he's getting blown up. He was an athlete, I think from Yale, who got killed on the battlefield. And it was this actually fairly moving piece of artwork that was in the newspaper that showed him about to die on the battlefield. So I think that began to alter how Ripley thought of his job. It wasn't just drawing these little funny-looking characters that you would think of as cartoony. He felt he could actually create art in the newspaper.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Neil Thompson. He's written a biography of Robert Ripley. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. If you have a question or comment for Neil Thompson, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. So, when he traveled around the world, it was a very different experience than when he traveled to South America for several months. In that case, he just decided he was going to do two things, try to pick up women and drink. And he wrote about that. That's what he wrote about.
He did, very openly about that, which both endeared him to me and amazed me that it was allowed to be published in the newspaper. It's funny to look back on it. So the series you're talking about was in 1925. Ripley did another, what the paper called Ramble. So this one was Ramble Across South America. This occurred at a time soon after Ripley had divorced his wife. They had been married for three sort of rough years. She was a Ziegfeld Follies dancer, and things ended badly, in part because Ripley couldn't stop chasing other women.
Well, he couldn't live with her.
Yeah.
That was weird.
To live with her, I know. He said he wasn't ready to share an apartment, so he wanted to keep his little room at the New York Athletic Club, and they lived in hotels. And he traveled a lot, and then finally his wife got fed up with it and said, either we settle down and act like a married couple or it's over, and it was over. So soon after that, he goes on this South American ramble and blatantly admits to readers that he was looking for love, and if he couldn't find love, he'd find a stiff drink. And so it's amazing. This is Prohibition era that he's writing during.
Right.
And he's almost writing in this taunting way back to Americans who have no legal access to alcohol. And he's describing what it's like to get a drink in the bar of the ship that he's on. He's describing what it's like to have waiters serve him chilled champagne in Panama. And he admits to drinking too much, and he admits to chasing women, not in a overly creepy way, but almost. There's one essay he describes meeting this young woman at a hotel near the El Misti volcano, and describes the evening they spent beneath the moonlight, and just very forthright and odd to be reading that kind of thing in your daily newspaper, but endearing too. He was just genuine about how he shared his personal feelings in print.
Now, he was drinking a lot, and I thought the end of the book was going to be his demise, you know, to cirrhosis of the liver. But eventually, this really told me a lot about him. Eventually, he limited his drinking. He wouldn't drink before 4 and had to be done by 7.
Right.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think he had a lot of discipline. You know, there were times he abandoned all that and overindulged. But I think there were times where he realized, I need to keep things in check if I'm going to keep this growing empire alive. You know, maybe we'll get to it, but this cartoon evolved into so many other enterprises, and it became this multimedia conglomeration where he was writing books, drawing the daily cartoon and the Sunday cartoon, radio programs, lectures, eventually museums. And so he needed at times to sort of rein in his excesses and establish some sort of routine and some discipline. So, yeah, I liked the restriction to only drinking between 4 and 7 p.m.
Well, tell us about how his career exploded and how that happened, because he worked his way up from the trenches. This did not happen overnight.
Hardly. And that's what I love about his story too, is that it's truly an underdog story, and it in a way helps explain how he became a champion of the underdog and of the misfit, because he worked in the trenches of newspapers for decades, for 20 years. During that time, he did create his Believe It or Not concept in that cartoon, but it didn't make him rich overnight. It wasn't until a few years after that 1925 South America trip, he was approached by a publisher, Max Schuster of what became Simon & Schuster. And Max said, hey, why don't you put some of your Believe It or Not cartoons and essays and drawings and stories into a book? And finally, Ripley agreed. This book, Believe It or Not, was published in 1929, and it became an instant huge bestseller. Just went into multiple printings. It got rave reviews all over the place. And that was really the beginning for Ripley. One of the early copies of the book landed with William Randolph Hearst, biggest newspaper man of his generation, who soon after sent a two-word telegram to one of his editors that said, hire Ripley. So Hearst and his King Features syndicate hired Ripley, and in 1929 gave him a salary that, with royalties and other things involved, was worth $100,000 a year.
Which is, compared to today's...
is a lot of money.
I'd take $100,000.
I know. It's astounding. And then within the next few years, he expands into, as I said, these other things, radio and lectures. And by the mid-1930s, as the rest of the country is suffering during the Depression, Ripley is making $500,000 a year.
Was he much of a philanthropist?
A little bit, yeah. It was hard for me to track specifics down, but there are many letters where he's donating money or cartoons to certain organizations. He had an affinity for orphan organizations and orphanages, I think because he felt like one. Mm-hmm. His father died when he was very young, and then his mother died when Ripley was, I believe, 25. So he viewed himself as an orphan. So he went out of his way to help orphans groups and boys clubs, big supporter of the Boy Scouts. So yeah, I think he tried to help when and where he could.
And he was supporting his mother for a time. He was also supporting a brother and a sister.
Right. He had a older brother and a younger sister. Older sister, younger brother. Mm-hmm. The brother was tricky. He did support his mother and brother for a long time. They stayed back in California when Ripley moved to New York. And then after his mother died, he tried to get his brother to come to New York and live with him and be part of his world. It didn't happen right away. The brother sort of bounced around from place to place and then eventually was convinced to come and live with Ripley and work as part of this growing, Believe It or Not, empire.
You know, it was kind of interesting when he traveled to South America that time, the one where he wrote about women and booze a lot. He noted afterward that travel was cheap. He did the whole trip for, it was several weeks for $750, cheap even by those standards then.
Right.
And he said Americans should do it more often. It was not common at all what he did at that time. And even now, very few people experience what he did.
It's true. I think he was a big believer in travel and a big believer in seeing other parts of the world and seeing other cultures and experiencing that. And he had sort of this disdain for either people who didn't travel or those who did travel but sort of stuck to the safe path. I think one thing that was remarkable about his travels is that he was willing to veer off that touristy path and explore deeply into some of these countries and try and get a sense of a true sense of the place and not just the main touristy sites. So he was a big advocate of travel, and it came through in his work.
And he didn't try to come across as an expert. It was truly the way he was experiencing as what people read about.
Yeah. And I think people appreciated that because he didn't come across as some polar explorer. That's not the kind of travel he did. He wasn't that adventurous. But it comes back to his curiosity. He wanted to learn more about the places he visited. So he wanted to dig a little bit deeper and go into, you know, in some of the Chinese cities he visited. He wanted to go back into the dark alleys and really see what the locals lived like. He used the word somewhat crudely. We would view it now. He talked a lot about the natives mm-hmm. of the places he visited, and that's who he wanted to spend time with, was the natives. So on the one hand, he's a little bit crass about how he refers to the locals, but he wants to be with them and around them. So that duality, I think, was fascinating and an interesting part of his sort of complex personality and his complex way of traveling the world.
And he, even after he was extremely wealthy, had a machine, you know, as far as his business went, had a machine going, huge operation by then, he still traveled.
Yeah, obsessively. As much and as often as he could, even when it was to the detriment of his, believe it or not, machine. I think he drove his employees crazy because he was never satisfied to stay still. The company kept growing. He kept moving even as the company was growing. The demands on him increased, but he still insisted on taking multiple trips every year and not easy ones either, you know, often to remote places, which would require him to transmit radio programs back from distant lands. He was just never content to rest easy and relax.
I'm talking with Neil Thompson. He's the author of a new biography of Robert Ripley. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we're meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
Of course.
Before Midnight is the third film following the relationship of two lovers who met on a train in Vienna in the 1995 film Before Sunrise. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Richard Linklater, and the stars Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, a big new push is on to rewrite federal regulations on the toxic chemicals in our lives. We'll look at whether it's a great compromise or a great sellout. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long condominiums, offering home ownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
Your annual support of 89.7 NPR News is our largest source of income. Visit WOSU.org/renew, and thanks for renewing your membership.
The casket of Queen Elizabeth I, while on view in Whitehall Palace, London, mysteriously exploded. The coffin was shattered, yet the Queen's body was unharmed, believe it or not.
Okay, I love that one. That's a cut from a 1930s vintage Ripley's Believe It or Not episode on radio. Always started with a quick teaser like that, and then followed with a longer story. Still with us, Neil Thompson, author of a new biography of Robert Ripley, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, that coffin story is a good example of it was too weird to believe, like so much of what he wrote about and put in his Sunday comic strip and so forth. And he was challenged often on his assertions, and he loved that.
Yeah, I think that became his shtick. Is he loved to dare people to prove him wrong. And it's been interesting talking about him and about the book, because it's hard to summarize what the cartoon was like at that time, because there was so much going on with it. Mm-hmm. I think today, if we think about Ripley's Believe It or Not, your first thought is something more on the grotesque end of the scale, you know, more freakish. Mm-hmm. But during his day, what he really primarily featured were these shockers, like the one we just heard, or a famous one that he displayed in this cartoon in 1927, where he declared that Charles Lindbergh was not the first man to cross the Atlantic, but the 67th. Which he then proved by explaining that there were two dirigibles that carried 30-plus people across the Atlantic, and then there was Alcock and Brown who crossed the Atlantic together. But by not using the word solo, he was able to say Charles Lindbergh was the 67th man to cross the Atlantic.
And the way he would do it, he would make this assertion in 1 week and then follow up the next week with the explanation.
Correct. Yeah.
Which just killed people.
To wait, and they would send letters in accusing him of either lying, which he loved, and at times would call himself the biggest. He took pride in being called the biggest liar in the world, because he also took pride in proving that he was actually telling the truth. So I think he appreciated the gamesmanship of it. That was one aspect of the cartoon, and then the radio shows, and then other bits of it were just introducing people to places and people from around the world that they might not have been exposed to before. There was a lot going on within that rectangle of the Believe It mm-hmm. or Not cartoon.
Phil in Columbus, you're on the air with Neil Thompson. Welcome, Phil.
Hi. A quick question about the book, prefaced by the fact that Ripley's Believe It or Not is obviously, it holds a fascination for children, big time. My son is 11. And I think he's worn the books from the Lumpus Library down to the nub. But my question is, he's 11, and he's also a huge history buff and encyclopedia of many things. But given some of the issues about Ripley and his opinions about women and the natives and all that kind of stuff, I'm not overly conservative. My question is, if he's 11, would the book be age appropriate for him?
I think absolutely, and I think for a couple of reasons, partly because it does teach you about what the world was like at that time. I stayed away from using any bad language, but I do portray Ripley kind of warts and all. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. the lesson there is this is how people viewed other parts of the world at that time. I think Ripley was reflected the average American's attitude toward other cultures. This fear, you know, at a time when the world was not as open as it is now, and so we had this either lack of understanding or, in some cases, fear of other parts of the world. And I think that's an interesting lesson for an 11-year-old. I have two sons; mine are 15 and 16, and I've tried to get them to read the book. They've read portions of it, but as a father of two, I'd say it's age appropriate.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Good question. Let's just move right on to Steve in Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Did Ripley have any descendants?
He did not. Thanks for the question, Steve. Unfortunately, he didn't. I wish he had, so I could have tracked them down and talked to them. We discussed earlier, he had an older sister and a younger brother. The brother did have two sons, so Ripley's nephews, and they're still alive, and I have spoken with them both. But they were so young at the time, they didn't really know their uncle. They remember a little bit, but not a whole lot. So Ripley, he was married briefly, but never had kids of his own.
Thank you, Steve, for that question. Are the descendants that he does have his brother's children, are they the ones that owned the Ripley Empire?
No, there was this difficult period after Ripley died, which was in 1949, where there was a little bit of a power struggle for the empire. His brother, who was not as business savvy as Ripley was involved in the organization, but he was kind of overwhelmed by the business side of things. It just wasn't his thing. And mm-hmm. I talked to his one of the nephew's daughters about it, and she describes it in the book as he was just, it wasn't his world. He didn't understand Ripley's world as well. So the power struggle meant that after Ripley's death, the brother was involved for a little bit and then sold out his portion of the business, and then by the mid-1950s, he had passed away himself. So there was no family control of the business, which changed hands a couple of times after that, and now is with this company called Ripley Entertainment.
Before we move on, I wanted to talk about his athleticism, something we've completely ignored at this point. He was really something. He was a great baseball player, could have been a professional, perhaps. He was the 1925 New York Athletic Club New York singles handball champ.
Yeah, I think athletics was important to him, and it was something that he considered pursuing as a career. We talked about him being sort of this geeky kid and mm-hmm. a little bit of a misfit, but he found himself both in his artwork and at that time on the baseball field. He just loved playing baseball and found that he was pretty good at it. Later, he tried his hand at boxing, wasn't bad at that either, and then handball. He was just very obsessed with staying fit and staying healthy, I think especially because his father had died at such a young age. He just loved sports and he was good at it.
And let me ask you, despite how wealthy he became, and he was one of the wealthiest people around, did he ever get his teeth fixed?
It's a good question. He did, finally in the mid 1930s, he had the first of several, operations to have them fixed, because they really were, if you see old pictures of him,
right,
really were pretty, pretty gnarly. So he had them fixed once. They actually had to research this to make sure it was true. They pulled all the teeth out and then replanted them at a less disfiguring angle. And then they were held in place for months after that, I think, with sort of braces. But interestingly, when he had that procedure done, he told his dentist or surgeon not to make them too perfect because the buck teeth were part of his
right.
brand.
Yes, because I noticed in later pictures that they're still protruding, but not quite so badly. I thought maybe his face just grew around him better. I don't know. That's interesting. Now, a lot of his stories came from his travels, but he also tapped the brain of a guy named Norbert Perlroth. He played a big role in Ripley's formula for success. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was an interesting partnership, Ripley and Pearl Roth. After that 1921 Around the World trip we discussed, Ripley came back with books and articles and magazines from other countries. It was interesting to me that Ripley, despite traveling the world throughout his whole life, refused to learn any other language. He would go to other places and just insist on speaking English and let the other guy figure it out. So he needed help at times with translation, as well as help with researching some of his Believe It or Nots. In 1923, he meets this guy, Norbert Pearl Roth, who is a banker here in New York, and asks him to assist with a couple of projects, mainly translation. Within a year, Pearl Roth has quit his job and is working full-time for Ripley as his primary researcher. And Pearl Roth did that job for decades, including well beyond when Ripley passed away in 1949. He would go to work almost every day to the New York Public Library and just dig through the stacks and try and find interesting tidbits that Ripley could use in his cartoons. So he was kind of the unheralded, silent partner in the enterprise, and really was key to the success of Believe It or Not.
Was Robert Ripley good to his employees?
I think he was. I think he worked them hard and drove them crazy at times because he would change plans on a whim. But I think what I ultimately liked about him is that he liked to have a good time. He liked to have fun. Sometimes, as we discussed earlier, too much. Sometimes he would drink too much. But he just loved to throw parties and have good food and good drink and have people around him. And that extended to his employees, where he liked to include them in everything he did. So I think working for him, he eventually ended up living and working on this island north of New York.
He
in a mansion.
He owned the island.
He owned the entire island, had a 28-room mansion, a pond, a bunch of boats on his pond. It was really this little wonderland. And a lot of his employees lived and worked there with him. And so it was this madcap, day-to-day existence for them, where he was working on his cartoons and then they'd have to rush him off to a radio show in New York. And he had a bar in the basement where he always had a beer keg tap so he could sip beer during the day. It was another example of Ripley living his life to the fullest, I believe.
Now let's talk briefly about the women. We talked about Beatrice Roberts, his first and only wife, right?
Correct.
Yeah, but they never really lived together. That was very strange. They divorced after 2 or 3 years, but really only were together about a year and a half or so.
That's right.
As a romantic couple. Did he have commitment issues? Am I being too 21st century or what? I mean, that was, I thought, very, very odd the way he came across to women or tried to come across to them. Very shallow.
Yeah, he was at times, and he would admit this in print, mm-hmm. either in interviews with other reporters. He would admit that he didn't understand women, which is interesting because he was so close to his mother and sister. And he, even in print, would convey his appreciation for other male-dominated cultures or places where it was easy to get a quick divorce. So it was very strange, but it's also interesting to learn that he did have one woman in his life who he at one point declared was the only love of his life. Mm-hmm. This is the woman named Ruth Ross. He nicknamed her Okie. And he met her sometime either in the late 1920s or early 1930s, and she worked for him, as did some of his other girlfriends, women who came to work for Ripley and then eventually became girlfriends and in some cases ended up living with him. But the one that really mattered the most to him was Okie. She traveled with him all over the world, but it turns out he couldn't commit to her because she was married.
Do you think he would have?
It's hard to say. Possibly not. Maybe I sort of hypothesize in the book that maybe it was the perfect arrangement for mm-hmm. him because they could be together without him needing to commit because she was committed to someone else.
If anybody out there is having a hard time imagining what this guy was like, he was the model for Elmer Fudd.
I love that tidbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. He The early version of Elmer Fudd was a character named Egghead, who dressed exactly like Ripley, which is to say, loudly, mm-hmm. you know, two-tone shoes, multicolored suits, and a top hat, and sometimes a cane, and a stutter. So the early version of Elmer Fudd was a character who was meant to sort of mock, in a way, the real Ripley.
How do you know that? I mean, was the creator of Elmer Fudd, did they say that?
I don't know if they ever did say that, but I found early, actually on YouTube, you can find them still, early versions of the Elmer Fudd character. Again, he's called Egghead. And it was a blatant, some of the episodes were blatant knockoffs of a Ripley episode where it's this character traveling around the world, visiting other places and saying, I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Okay. How did Ripley do on television?
He was awkward. He was definitely not a very telegenic guy. But I think, in a way, and this applies to radio as well, people appreciated that, that he was willing to do it, even though he wasn't the most eloquent performer. I think they appreciated that he was like them, but he could still get up there on the air and on TV and share himself and share his stories. I think people really responded.
You know, we've covered a lot of, a lot of area this morning about Robert Ripley, but that none of this should suggest that we've even tapped a fraction of what you write about in his book. This guy had, there were so many elements to his life, it's impossible to get at all of them. I was wondering if you could talk about his later years, how he eventually died, and how, you know, who was with him, what was his later life like?
Yeah, and you're right. There's so much to the story, which I just love. There's so many aspects that we haven't touched on. But it ends sort of in a melancholy way. Because he loved to travel so much, I think World War II really affected him. He was not able to travel during that time. He bought a Chinese fishing boat that he converted into this strange yacht toward the tail end of World War II, just so he could escape and travel at least up and down the East Coast in that. After World War II, he started to have some health issues, and I think he had some emotional issues too. I think he was affected by the changing world around him. There's this scene I describe in 1948 where he is finally able to travel back to China, his favorite country, and he's just devastated by what he sees, the destruction of cities he once loved, like Shanghai. And he came back from that trip kind of an emotional wreck, despite being kind of troubled by that and at that time drinking too much once again. Mm-hmm. He launched into his first TV show in 1949, and then it was the 13th episode of that TV program where he was featuring the funeral song Taps, and during that show suffered some kind of heart attack and slumped over, almost passed out, managed to get through the show, but then 2 days later in the hospital suffered another attack and died at the age of 59.
Isn't that something? I tell you, he lived it completely beginning to end. Neil Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
And I really enjoyed it. Thanks for your interest.
Neil Thompson, veteran journalist and author of a new biography. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Great thanks to the All Sides staff this week. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Chaban, Shannon Clary, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmiski and Amber Karsmiski. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming at the web on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.